Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Former IMF chief economist Raghuram Rajan famously and publicly warned Fed chief Alan Greenspan in 2005 that an unhealthy market risked unraveling into a full-blown crisis. He was right. Now he's warning that the jobs we've lost in the Great Recession may not come back, that the country is not prepared to deal with prolonged high unemployment, that all could fail again and take China and India down, too. This hour, On Point, a stark warning of economic risk ahead and what we need to do to avert a deeper crisis. You can join the conversation. What happens if the job market simply does not recover? What really happens here? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Raghuram Rajan, professor of finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He's an economic advisor to the Prime Minister of India, author of Saving Capitalism from the Capitalists, and his new book, Fault Lines, How Hidden Fractures Still Threaten the World Economy. Raghuram Rajan, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You look at so many facets of what we've been in the midst of and what we're in the midst of right now, but your thoughts on unemployment really grabbed my attention here. I mean, here we are since, June 1st that federal unemployment benefits began to expire, 300,000-plus jobless workers cut off. That'll be 1.25 million by the end of this month unless Congress extends benefits. And yesterday, the Senate took a pass on that. How do you see the unemployment that we're sitting on in this country rippling through politically, socially, economically?
Well, I think what's happened is the nature of recoveries have changed. It used to be that the U.S. went into recession and came out quickly. 8 months after the trough of the recession, the jobs that were lost in the recession were back. Mm-hmm. Things started changing in 1991. It took 23 months for jobs to come back from the trough of the recession then. In 2001, the 2001 recession, it took 38 months for jobs to come back. This recession looks even worse. Remember, we had 5% unemployment going into the recession. By most counts, growth started turning positive again in July 2009. So we're already nearly a year into the recovery. Mm-hmm. And, the job situation still looks bleak. By most economists' count, if we ever get back to the 5%, we probably will, it'll be 4 or 5 years.
4 or 5 years is a long time. You warned that things could turn down again. In the meantime, it's long enough for an awful lot of pain and tension. Why is this happening? Why is our economy not producing jobs?
Well, that's a mystery. There are theories. I mean, some people argue that what's happening is this deep structural change. The jobs, for example, that were lost in the past used to be auto workers laid off for a little while. Inventories went down. They were rehired. But now GM is downsizing, and the jobs that GM has lost will never come back because, GM was too big given the economy and everybody elsewhere is producing cars. Similarly, that's one theory, that it's about layoffs turning into permanent layoffs as opposed to just temporary layoffs. A second theory is actually that, the techniques for hiring have become better. Used to be in the past when you went into a recession and started coming out, companies took fright. Maybe we'll lose sales if we don't hire quickly. Mm-hmm. So let's go out and hire people quickly before the recovery gets strong so that we have people to, produce the goods and not lose any sales in the process. Now, with the time taken to hire people becoming quite short because of all the technological advances we have, companies are willing to wait and see and look to see if the recession is well and truly over, if people are buying. And in this wait-and-see mood, if everybody's waiting to see, nobody's actually creating those jobs, which means the recession, the jobs recovery could actually be more prolonged. So that's another theory. There's not that much evidence in favor of any of these theories. So we're still a little flummoxed. I mean, it could also be that companies have overinvested and are trying to sort of squeeze out whatever productivity gains they can and waiting again and seeing again for sustained recovery. And also thinking about whether they should be investing more in the U.S. or investing more elsewhere. There are theories, lots of theories, no clear evidence that one of them is the right one.
Lots of theories, but that leaves us with this one reality of millions of Americans out of work. You put a lot of emphasis on the risks and kind of tension that come, fault lines is the metaphor you use here, with the inequality that has mounted in this country, and how, unemployment obviously just exaggerates it.
Absolutely. So let me start first with the inequality itself, which I think is a deeper, slow-burning crisis which has been going on for some time in this country. Most people, when they think of inequality, think of hedge fund managers, John Paulson making 75,000 times the average household income in 2008. But that's not the critical inequality that's mounting, in my view. What is happening is people at the 90th percentile of the income distribution, typically a manager in a Walmart store, for example.
90th, that's then, in the top 10% you're talking?
In the top 10%. Mm-hmm. Their wages are running away from the wages of the median worker, typically in a factory. Economists have spent some time trying to think about why this is the case. And the most plausible answer is the person at the 90th percentile has a degree, usually an undergrad, and that degree makes a lot of difference in their wage profile and how that has moved, because increasingly jobs require more skills. And unfortunately, in the United States, while the demand for more skills has been steadily increasing over time, it's been increasing over the entire century. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the 1910s, it used to be demand for high school graduates who could actually work in a factory and not on the fields. Now it's the demand for people who can work on computers and write jazzy programs. But that demand has kept pace through the century. What has not kept pace recently is the supply. High school graduation rates have remained stagnant for the last 35 years. If you look at college graduation rates, especially for males, and this is another part of the social problem we can come to, mm-hmm. male graduation rates have remained relatively stagnant over the last 30, 35 years. Female graduation rates have improved considerably. But what this means is the supply of the skills that are needed for the jobs the economy is creating, simply not there. If you look at unemployment rates right now, they're much lower for graduates than unemployment rates for high school educated workers, and also for minorities who typically have a lower level of education. The problems, in some sense, of unemployment are compounding the earlier problems of growing income inequality. My book is emphasizing the fact that these problems are creating subsidiary problems, which, in fact, might have been responsible for the crisis that we saw.
There's a lot to look at there. We'll unpack it. We've got lots of callers, and I want to begin to turn to them as well. Raghuram Rajan is with us, former chief economist for the International Monetary Fund. We're staring a lot of unemployment right in the face and bigger long-term problems, he says. Bannister, Michigan. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Lovely to talk to you. Thanks for having me on the show. Mm-hmm. Dr. Rajan, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, genius. Absolute genius. I'm part of the situation myself. I'm part of what they're now calling the new permanently unemployed. I'm an ex-business manager. In 16 days, we're going to lose unemployment benefits in the state of Michigan, probably for the better part of 750,000 people. What are those people going to do? I mean, when we're talking, it's going to take 5 years to get jobs back. What are we going to do? We can't put these people on hold. What's going to happen when people start to not be able to feed their kids? What's going to happen when people can't pay the mortgage and somebody says, get out? I mean, that's happening already.
And Tom, you're one of these people that you're describing.
Exactly.
What do you think is going to happen?
I shudder to think. I studied too much history, and it scares the heck out of me. I mean, in the past histories, the revolutions have been fought with sticks and stones. That in this country, where the Second Amendment is basically part of Holy Writ, people who are going to be kicked out on the street and can't afford their kids' food, they own guns. We've had 4 bank robberies in the city of St. John's, just a city of 16,000 people, not 20 miles from my house.
Wow.
I mean, this is not good, and it's time the government and people who were up on the top there, who don't know how people down at the bottom live, it's time they woke up.
Tom, that's as real as it gets, and you put the timeline right on it. 16 days for an awful lot of people. Good luck there. I hope you find something soon, and thank you for your call. Raghuram, what do you say?
Well, it's painful, and all I can say is we should have been better prepared for this. Of course, that's water under the bridge right now. One of the problems, I think, why this gridlock in Congress is that while there are some things that are essential, one of the arguments I make in my book is for automatic unemployment benefit extensions depending on the state of the economy. So that would perhaps have taken care of the kind of situation we see approaching in Michigan.
But even if it were that way, how many years, how many decades can we just, support people on unemployment? People want jobs. They want real incomes.
Well, that's the second part of it, that we need to create the capabilities. Now, let me tell you about the long-term solution. Let's talk about the short-term solution, right? The longer-term solution has to be that we equip people for the new economy, which means a revolutionary sort of approach towards education. And we can talk about it when we come back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about deep, unresolved challenges to our economy and the world, about what happens if we can't find jobs. We're talking with Raghuram Rajan, former chief economist for the International Monetary Fund. He's a professor at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. His new book is Fault Lines: How Hidden Fractures Still Threaten the World Economy. He called the big meltdown of 07, 08, couple of years before it came, and right in the face of Alan Greenspan. Now he's warning we've got big structural problems still in front of us. We could have some pretty rough times here. He joins us from New York. We have so many callers. I want to hear some of their voices because people are living this. Let's go to Naples, Florida, and John, you're on the air.
Well, thank you for having me on the show today. As you know, down here in Naples, we're suffering, as the rest of the country is, from the big downturn in the building business.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing like trends, which I've been observing for the last 5 or 6 years. One on the retail side, where traditional brick and mortar stores are suffering; they're having to close down, put people out the door, whatever it is, because they're competing so much with internet sales.
Right. Even shoes, you name it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything. And fortunately for me, I work for a firm in which we do. We do electronics and electrical for super high-end estate homes, the wealthiest people in the country I do work for.
Right.
But even in that marketplace, believe it or not, there has been a dramatic slowdown in the number of estate homes being built and things like that. What happens typically down here is, say, a firm, be it a cabinetry shop or an electrical firm or an AV company, they go out of business, then when these other people, the employees can't find jobs at other companies,
right,
they go into business for themselves and work out of their house. And I'm wondering if your guest would agree with me in seeing that there's going to be a nationwide, maybe worldwide trend in the development of a cottage industry where people start to work more out of their home, running their own business, providing the services that they used to provide when they worked for employers.
I'll put that to Dr. Rajan, but John, is your observation in Naples that people can make the same living in the sort of cottage industry version of their jobs as they did with the company?
Yeah, there are actually, I've spoken with a lot of people who have been laid off at companies, and they then take those skills that they had and they start, they go get business cards, a small website. they start doing, jobs for people that they were typically doing for employers.
And doing it from home. John, I appreciate your call from Naples. Raghuram Rajan, how about it? Are we going to be doing the equivalent of weaving and spinning at home?
Well, I think this is a broader point that we are going to adapt. And I think America has always adapted. It's painful, but it happens. I talk in the book about a friend of mine, Badri, who lost his job, well-paying job, in a chip manufacturer. Mm-hmm. And he's left without any unemployment insurance because they filed for bankruptcy, without any benefits because they filed for bankruptcy. And he has to fend for people in his family and the mortgage payments, et cetera. What he does eventually, 6 or 7 months after painful searching for a similar job, essentially decides to downgrade, takes a job at half the pay, 900 miles away from his home, can't sell the home, of course, now, and works, lives in a one-room apartment in Chicago, commuting to work there, and sees his family every month.
But,
people are adapting.
But, I mean, adapting sounds like such a mild word for that. That's an economic catastrophe compared to the American dream.
It is. Now, what one hopes is that this is a change which eventually moves, when the economy gets better, you go back to a better standard of living. So as the caller mentioned, lots of people starting businesses out of homes. This keeps them going. Some of those businesses will flourish and become industries in their own right. In other situations, people will keep some bread on the table, but once the jobs start coming back, they will go back to work in something which looks like their old job. But for many, for the 47-year-old person laid off from GM, it may mean a permanent adaptation and a permanent downgrade in lifestyle. And that is the person that perhaps the first caller was talking about and that we should be thinking much more seriously about.
Living in one room, seeing the family once a month. I mean, it sounds like what we used to read about, South African coal miners or something. Andy in Boston is calling. Andy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm one of the ranks of the highly educated people unemployed. I'm actually on my way to my 10th job fair, if I get lucky. I'm not sure about that.
Wow.
But, however, I do disagree with the professor's note, and I think that probably will tie into a question also.
Mm-hmm.
If you're highly educated, that actually puts you in a little bit of a conundrum. Employers look at you saying you're so educated, why do you want to, you're not going to stick around even if I give you a job. On the other hand, I want to go back and maybe get an MBA, but if I look at the statistics, half the people in school are already not able to find work.
Right.
Because the finance industry is dried up. I'm from India, so I've been actually debating, as the last caller, as the professor mentioned, maybe take a one step back, relocate to India or commute back and forth. So I'd like to hear the professor's view on that.
What about it, Raghuram? I mean, there's a highly educated caller going off to his 10th job fair, no job, and it doesn't seem like a solution to him. I mean, he's thinking of leaving the country for India.
Yeah. Well, some of that is occurring, and that's another form of adaptation. But the person, Badri, that I talk about in the book is a PhD and has the same problem that the caller has. He's over-educated in a very specialized area and finds that, factories are closing down. So what he does is he sort of redefines himself and takes a job at half the pay. I'm not suggesting the caller should do that, but it is tough at the higher ends also. However, I think when the economy comes back, those jobs will come back. But the jobs in, say, the auto industry will not. And so my sense is that there is need for a more permanent solution. I think the problem also is that we've been looking at halfway fixes. And I would say the whole housing bubble is essentially an attempt at a halfway fix. One of the points I argue in my book is that housing for many politicians seemed an attractive way for people to participate in the American dream. But also, while there's paycheck stagnated, if house prices increased and they could borrow against the housing, then they could keep up consumption levels.
Well, reading you make it sound as though we've been kind of in la-la land for a couple of decades here. I mean, interest rates held down, housing bubble allowed to inflate, everybody felt good, but this wasn't really building economic strength.
I that's exactly the point I'm making, that this is a slow-burning crisis which has been long in coming, and that we got diverted. We got diverted, and that was a financial crisis. We got diverted through housing, and then housing blew up in our face, and now many of the people who need to move across states to get new jobs elsewhere, the few jobs that are being produced, can't because they're held down by mortgages that they can't pay. And, you know, this is a disaster coming from, you know, short-term attempts at solutions, solutions that appeared quite effective for a while. Both the Republican mm-hmm. Party and the Democratic Party signed on to the idea. From the Democrats, it was affordable housing. From the Republicans, it was ownership society. Both expected that they would enhance their popularity, Democrats because the money went to their natural constituencies, Republicans because they thought more homeowners would vote for them. And they both pushed housing very strongly. And now we have a housing disaster, but we still have the longer-term problem, which is that there aren't enough jobs for the kinds of qualifications that many of the people in the country have.
You describe that bubble as almost a kind of, distraction or cover-up of the real problems beneath. Let's get another call from Florida, Fort Myers, Florida. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. I just had a few comments. I think we're reaping the rewards of our globalized economy, the inevitable globalized economy, but there's a reason T-shirts cost $2 for, for 2 for $5 at,
right.
at Walmart.
Right.
I'm unemployed. I'm not an economist, but I used to live in L.A. and made a pretty decent salary, and during the whole ramp up with the housing bubble, and prices were just ridiculous, and I knew that something was going to happen. And I think you're right. We have been living in la-la land. We are paying the price now. And that's pretty much what I have to say.
Yeah, Mark, we wish you good luck there. And let me get one more right here, if I may. Thanks. From Baltimore, Maryland, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for speaking here. I got a couple of points. I just... personally, on my personal values have changed as far as consumering things go. I always look now at what I want versus what I really, really need. And my career has been like 27 years with UPS, so as a metric of what's being bought and sold and shipped,
right?
That's a fair metric, I suppose. And our volume is dropped considerably and stayed consistently low for the first time in my 27-year career. They haven't hired people over the past 5 years. In fact, we've dropped that. But I want to know now, I used to think that I was going to be at a point right now in my life where I'd retire and take my pension,
mm-hmm.
and that's changed, and I'm going to probably continue to work another 5 years. That's probably true across the board for a lot of baby boomers. But as the baby boomers move out of the economy and there are fewer people to replace them, will that not bring jobs back?
It's a good question, Chris. Let me ask you before I let you go. Do you see an uptick in your deliveries? Do you see economic activity picking up in your UPS deliveries, Chris?
Only very, very slightly. Nothing, that would cause anybody to go out and celebrate. I see a consistent, steady drop in volume over the past couple of years since the economic crisis has come in.
Let us pick it up. So we've got two things on the table there, Raghuram. From Fort Myers, the question about, the globalized economy and what it's meant to see so much manufacturing move offshore. What happens with that? What if American consumers aren't buying? And then you hear our UPS caller, Chris, saying, well, maybe the baby boomers work a little longer than they expected, but then they clear out. Then we need everybody, and unemployment comes back.
Right. Well, employment will come back. There's no question about that. The main question is how rapidly. And we started talking about globalization. I mean, globalization has brought benefits. Many of the employment benefits have been at the upper levels of the economy, but the consumption benefits have been to everybody. As you just said, Walmart, much of the cheap stuff that you can buy at Walmart, which everybody benefits from, is produced overseas, and it does increase people's standard of living. It does also mean, of course, that manufacturing tends to move overseas, and that has been a trend over the last last 30 years. The question is, how do we replace those jobs? And certainly there are jobs at the lower end, jobs of gardener, house worker. Those are not going to be outsourced. But it's the jobs in the middle that people abroad can do far more effectively now than they used to, and they are being shipped outside. That leaves jobs at the higher end. And this, again, reemphasizes the need to create a workforce which is more skilled, more capable of doing those jobs so that the jobs that are available actually can be taken by that workforce. Now, in the medium term, over the next 5 years, demand from these other countries is going to grow tremendously. Demand from Brazil, from China, from India is going to grow, and the U.S. will benefit from that. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. is going to be on a rising tide at that point. And so I don't have a concern about jobs in the medium term, especially if we can upskill the workforce. It's the transition from here to there that we have to worry about, that as the first caller again said, when unemployment benefits run out and people lose their homes, what are they going to do? That transition is very, very worrisome. There's another transition we have to worry about, and that is the people who are trained for very specific jobs but don't have the flexibility to move elsewhere and probably will have to downgrade their living standards. What happens to them? Again, the 47-year-old auto worker is a case in point, because those jobs have gone. And, we economists bandy around the word retraining very easily.
Yeah.
And certainly the government is focused on trying to do some retraining. But typically, retraining is difficult. And retraining to a job which is equivalent is usually very, very hard. Very few workers get retrained in that fashion. So for most people, it will mean a reduction in living standards, people who are in that category.
I'm hearing too much about downward mobility here. I mean, how many American jobs are you really going to want as gardeners and housekeepers? You know, admirable work needs to be done, but it's never paid traditionally. One of the things you write about is this gap between the traditional expectation that even people in fairly modest jobs could imagine that they or their kids might hit it big, you know, start the auto dealership, whereas now the wealthy maybe are hedge fund traders and ordinary people can't figure out how that would ever be them.
Well, that's where education is the bridge, and this is where our education system is not really delivering the goods. And it needs to be more than just – so education is a complex thing, right? It's not just about the schools. It's about families. It's about communities. It's that whole process which gives a young person the willingness to work hard in school and to be prepared for college. So that's one part of what we need to fix. We need to create more young people who are capable of going through college and acquiring the skills that they need. But we also need to work very hard at the adult population, which needs to be reskilled. And that's where I think some combination of technology and new private energy will probably help, but also there may be some need for government support. So when I talk about new technology, there's all these new schools opening up, which give you the ability to do college courses at a distance at fairly low prices. $100 per college credit, for example, is one idea I've heard recently, which is actually being put into place. So perhaps what this demand for education will do is, over the next few years, create a big supply of education that, in fact, the 47-year-old worker can take advantage of. And what we need in the next few years is a bridge to keep them sort of with house and home together until they get prepared once again for the jobs that are available.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about deep unresolved challenges to our economy and maybe the world's, about what really happens if we can't find jobs. Raghuram Rajan is with us, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He's out of the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. His new book is Fault Lines: How Hidden Fractures Still Threaten the World Economy. Raghuram Rajan joins us from New York. We've had so many callers for you. I should just get you to lay out some more of these hidden fractures you're describing threatening the world economy. I've read you saying that we're on a terrible path and that we're not having the important conversations we need to have about how to really deal with our challenges.
Well, yes. And so we've laid out a couple of the fault lines already. One is the growing inequality in the United States as a result of the fact that much of the population is increasingly doesn't have the skills for the jobs that are being created. And the jobs that represent the upward mobility that you talked about, unfortunately, now, without the education, they can't actually aspire to those jobs. And so, you know, education or the lack of it is doing more to hold people back now than ever before.
I'm seeing so much skepticism, though, here on that front, Raghuram. I mean, in our comments all over the place, coming in on Facebook and the web, people saying, what are you talking about? You know, I've got a great education, my wife's got a great education, and we don't have jobs.
Let's distinguish the downturn from the more permanent movement over time. So the downturn is certainly one in which many educated people have lost their jobs. And, you know, the statistics for college graduates is bad. But it's a lot better than the statistics for high school graduates, and even better than the statistics for those who haven't had high school. So it's a relative, what we're talking about is a relative statement at this point. Yes, there are many educated unemployed at this point, but in the longer run, over the last 30 years, the educated have done much, much better and will continue to do better when the recovery comes.
But there aren't enough, so we've got inequality and we need to have more upskilling the workforce. You trips off your tongue easily, but of course we've found that painfully hard to do in this country. What other fissures, fault lines are you pointing to?
Well, the second, which we again talked about, is that the nature of recoveries has changed for reasons that we don't comprehend fully, you know, companies aren't creating jobs as quickly as they used to. They're trying to improve productivity. They may be moving investment abroad. That's another concern. But the third concern, which sort of adds to all this, is the rest of the world and the kinds of policies they've followed. That those policies have tried to typically follow a strategy of export-led growth, producing more goods than they consume and sending those goods abroad, typically to countries that are willing to consume more than they produce, a.k.a. The United States. Mm-hmm. And that strategy has been extremely successful as a way of growth for countries ranging from Japan, Germany, to now China. Mm-hmm. But of course, for somebody to produce more than they consume means that they need to have a counterpart, and typically that counterpart, if they consume
buyer,
more than they
is.
Produce,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The buyer, is essentially buying fueled by debt. Their consumption is fueled by debt. And eventually that leads to a problem. We've seen such a problem in Greece where the government spent more, much more than it could mm-hmm. possibly afford. Mm-hmm. We see that problem in the United States where households have spent more than they can afford. And we've seen many of the countries that ran large trade deficits now in serious trouble. So this export-led strategy has to change for the world to become more stable.
I mean, if the U.S.'s consumer is tapped out now, what does that mean for China?
That means that they have to focus on trying to get their own consumers to spend. Now, the problem in China is that household incomes have been relatively low as a fraction of total national income. And that's because, to some extent, the household has been repressed with low interest rates on deposits, with low wages on work, with subsidies being given to the firms. And as a result, the household doesn't have that much to spend. They do save, but they don't save extraordinary amounts relative to their income. Mm-hmm. What has to happen in China, and we see that happening in front of our eyes,
the labor movement rustling up.
Exactly.
There.
Mm-hmm. Labor movement is getting stronger. Workers are demanding higher wages. That will be part of the rebalancing process. And it will imply that increasingly the Chinese will consume more. And as they consume more movies, as they consume more electronics, much of the intellectual capital for that was going to come from the United States. It's not going to be U.S. manufacturers who are going to benefit as much as U.S. service providers. And that's, again, goes back to the point that the U.S. has to create the skills that will provide those services.
Here's a web comment from Jody. It says, I was laid off from a professional sales position in August, was planning to go to graduate school, more education. This fall, this week, my husband was also laid off from his sales position, so her education plans are postponed. Her unemployment runs out this fall, but his will kick in, but it's still not enough to cover their mortgage. That's the kind of thing people are up against all over this country. Charles in Nashville. Charles, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I have heard the arguments that this gentleman is speaking. I've heard them all my life, and I would take issue to every point he makes. The fact is that there's no such thing as free markets. The politicians got together and took American jobs and decided that they would be better suited to go to China, Mexico. That was a manipulation of this market. Until those jobs come back, until the American consumer is the engine of the world. It's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
Today that the American consumer decides that they're going to stop buying unless it's built in America,
yep.
then things will change, I guarantee you. And I guarantee you it will never change. I have a little college. My wife have a little college.
Yep.
We make over $1,000 a week each. But I'm telling you, education, if you got natural intellect, college is like a waste of time. If you're smart, college is a waste of time. You learn on the job. There needs to be more job on-the-job training. That's what we need to get back to instead of focusing on college. There needs to be more job on-the-job training.
This is a real kind of a down-and-dirty analysis of what's going on, and I appreciate it, Charles Raghuram Rajan. You know, Charles, I think, and many others have grown skeptical in this last couple years about this whole vision the United States will move on up some ladder to some, you know, heaven of new jobs in the sky while China and India do the stuff that Americans used to do. And now here we are, and I think people are looking around and not entirely seeing that, not in the volume that's going to, you know, pick up our labor force and really give it compensation.
Look, I think this is a natural reaction to have at this point, and I totally sympathize with the caller. The truth is that the American consumer has been spending for a long time and needs time to rebuild balance sheets.
How do you do that if you've adapted, as you say, to lower income?
Well, American consumers are saving much more. The American household is saving much more now than
a percentage, but maybe of a smaller income.
The aggregate income hasn't gone down. Yes, it has gone down substantially for some people. Mm-hmm. But remember, we're talking about a fraction of the population, less than 10% of the workforce. Undoubtedly, it is very painful for people who are forced to downsize. But the broader point that I want to make is that growth increasingly is coming from outside the United States. We have been the engine of world growth for some time. But increasingly, other countries are going to be the engine of world growth. This would be the wrong time in history to turn inward and say, okay, we're sick of the world. We're going to turn inward, erect protectionist barriers. First, we kill their growth. We may not care that much about it. But if our future lies in their growth, then we should care about it because eventually they're going to buy the stuff that we produce. And this is not a pipe dream. It is a reality. Today, the emerging markets are producing much more growth and buying more goods than the industrial countries. And this is going to increase only over time because they're growing much faster. It would be a bad time to turn our backs on the world. The answer is not to erect huge barriers to keep those jobs from going away. Those jobs are going to go away, whatever barriers you erect. But instead, it is to create the capabilities for people to provide the kinds of to do the kinds of jobs that are coming. And that is a forward-looking strategy which America has invariably embraced and should embrace once again.
Well, we know that message, and I hear it. At the same time, I can probably imagine our caller Charles shaking his head right now. Steve in Waltham, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I come from the camp of people that feel that the extension of unemployment benefits is actually bad for the economy.
Mm-hmm.
I am a small employer. I rely on cheap labor and the availability of workers in order to sustain my business. I enjoy or I benefit from a slow economy. And with the extension of unemployment benefits, I've noticed in a down economy with fewer people actually looking for work than there should be out there. And as a result of that, I can't grow my business. And I also think that there's a negative effect of prices being artificially sustained when they should be coming down in a slow economy. I think that if you can find a job bagging groceries at the supermarket for $10 or $12 an hour, which should be around $8 an hour, and the prices aren't going to come down until there's a huge influx of workers looking for work, because they're not looking because they're still on unemployment benefits, it's going to give an artificial buoyancy to prices, which is going to possibly, aside from delaying the eventual bouncing back of the economy,
yeah,
also Steve, negatively affect inflation.
Yeah, Steve, I understand exactly what you're saying. I mean, you're a small business. You hire low-wage workers. So high unemployment's great for you because it should push people toward you willing to work for those low wages. I get it for your business. But what does that mean for the whole country if that's where people are pushed?
You know, I feel for people who are out of work. I feel for people who need, who believe they need those extension of unemployment benefits in order to survive. But the reality is, when the economy gets slow, employers have the benefit of having a greater labor pool to bring their costs down, and they then eventually will take that savings and
build the business. Watch out for the train there, Steve. We don't want you to get hurt. Raghuram, you hear the small business, low-wage business argument there. You argue, on the other hand, we should have automatic extension of unemployment benefits.
Well, I'm trying to drive a middle path between the first caller, who naturally expressed concern about what happens if the jobs aren't coming back. You're looking, and I have friends who've done that, and there's nothing available. So you are not sitting on your backside at home waiting for the job to come. You're trying everything, and you still don't get a job. And the first caller expressed concerns about, having to be forced out of the home and not having food on the table. That's a real concern in a civilized society. You can't let that happen in a big way. Forget the unrest and the political unrest and the crime and so on and the armed rebellion that was hinted at that point by the first caller. Even before that, I mean, it's just immoral, it seems to me, to let a large part of the population suffer in that way. On the other hand, there is a business argument to be made that you don't want permanent high unemployment benefits because it does reduce over time the willingness to go look for work. You just have to look in Europe to see the consequences of permanent high unemployment benefits. It creates a permanent underclass of the permanently unemployed. So there is a middle ground, and the middle ground I'm proposing is, based on the economic situation, you have temporary but predetermined extensions on unemployment benefits. I worry when politicians get into the act, and this is part of the problem that is holding up the current bill, that there's a whole lot of pork which is laid on to what seems a pretty well-defined need. And so what I would propose, at least if these recoveries are as slow as they have been, is to try and legislate towards more permanent extensions based on economic conditions.
Let me get one more call here. Rick in Lexington, Massachusetts. Rick, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. By way of background, actually, I have a PhD in biochemistry and have been unemployed for 2 years.
Wow.
With all due respect to your guest, I think I've heard quite a bit of economists sort of telling the rest of us how to run the world in our lives, but I can't help noting the irony of his own academic institution, the University of Chicago, which, of course, has been highlighted as one of the real intellectual breeding grounds of the laissez-faire deregulatory economic approach.
Indeed.
Which arguably is responsible not just for the mortgage bubble, but for the dot-com bubble and a number of other bubbles. And my question is, what is happening within the economic community? We, the people, would actually like to shine the light back on economists and ask, what's happening, and in particular at the University of Chicago? Is there any rethinking of this economic approach?
In the bastion of free market economics, how about it, Professor Rajan?
Well, Let me first say that Chicago gets a bad rep because it is associated, for good reason, I must say, with a couple of individuals in the past who had certainly a strong view on free markets. Chicago is a bigger school. It is a big tent. There are lots of people from different persuasions within that tent.
But it's only a couple of years ago that this wasn't even considered a bad rep. It was just a reputation, and Chicago was proud of it.
No, I don't think we want to dissociate ourselves from the fact that some of our faculty members have been very strongly for free markets. Most of us believe that markets work pretty well. But the notion that we are for an anarchy, that we don't think that markets need to be regulated, that we think that somehow take away all government and things will be fine, I mean, this is just plain ridiculous. And you know, to some extent, we are to blame. I think the popular view of Chicago is it's a bunch of right-wing loonies. And I think that if you really do come to Chicago and you see the debates that go on there between a wide variety of segments of the population, of the faculty population, you will see it's much richer than that.
We've only got about 10 seconds. I want to ask you, you advise the Prime Minister of India on economics. What do you tell the Prime Minister there about the future of the United States economy? Coming back or in big trouble?
I think it's coming back.
How long?
I mean, I think the recovery will be slow. But 2 or 3 years, I think, at least for the most of the population, it will look like we're back on track. There will be a category, and I keep emphasizing this, that we need to worry about, we need to figure out how to help.
Fault Lines is the new book. Raghuram Rajan is the author. Professor Rajan, thank you very much for joining us.
Most welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.